welcome back to The Right Turn, your one-stop shop for all things fiction writing. I'm your host, author Jordan M. Griffin, and today I have a super special episode. We are here with T.M. Blanchett. T.M. Blanchett is the founder of Operation Delta Dog, which rescues shelter dogs and works to train them to pair with veterans as service animals. She is also the founder and host of A Mighty Blaze podcast, which features best-selling and debut authors to chat craft, industry, and everything in between. In addition, she is the author of the Neath Trilogy, which welcomes its final installment, Herrick's Key, on April 23rd. So, T.M. Blanchett, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Why, thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about what you write and kind of what genre you fall into?
Oh, the tricky question. Technically, you would call it fantasy, YA mm-hmm. fantasy in the case of the Neath Trilogy. To be honest with you, for a long time, I wasn't even aware of such distinctions. I just sort of wrote what I wanted to write. And then the publishing industry itself are the ones who narrow it into little boxes. In general, what I really love to write is something that looks like our world. It looks and smells and sounds just like your everyday world, but there's a secret underbelly to it all, things that the regular people don't know are there, like a magical undertone that only the people in the know about. And that tends to happen in almost every book I write. And in the case of the Neath Trilogy, which started with Herrick's End, it's a literal underground. It's a world below the city of Boston that is magical.
Very cool. So delving into kind of what the publishing industry, because they love labels, would call maybe an urban fantasy or some kind of magical realism.
Right. I think probably magical realism. I used to say urban fantasy because it's in a city, but it turns out I believe urban fantasy is more, it's very gritty and adult, has a lot of sex and drugs and rock and roll, that sort of thing. And mine definitely is not like that. It's more of a heartwarming adventure story for kind of all ages.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. It's so difficult to navigate those terms because you hear one and you think it sounds like, oh yeah, that's what I write. And then you realize it has all these nuances. So for a long time, I used to say that I wrote new adult because I genuinely mm-hmm. think a lot of what I write fits right between YA and adult. It's kind of for mm-hmm. that, you know, like 18 to 25. And then I found out that new adult is actually just a term for like heavy romance books.
Oh, really? See, I didn't know that either.
So now I have to use something different.
And it depends on who you ask as well.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so talking industry, right? So you are now on your third novel. So let's go back a little bit. So after finishing that first novel, what happened next? Did you start looking for agents right away, or did you go for small presses right away? Walk us through that a little bit.
Well, I have to back you up a bit because it's not my third novel, it's my third published novel. So technically I've written probably about 15 novels. And that gives you a sense of how long it can take to get the attention of an agent, a publisher, those kinds of things. I've been at this for more than 25 years. Always writing novels, just over and over and over again, and scrapping them and throwing them away and learning my lessons and starting all over again. I started querying way back when. Literally, I started querying when you still had to put a stamp on a paper envelope and put it in your mailbox. That's when I started querying. So let's just say I could wallpaper a house with my rejections. But I just kept at it because I loved it. And then with Herrick's End, I was querying at the height of a pandemic. So in mm-hmm. 2020, and everyone told me, oh, you should just wait. You should wait till all this is over because of the pandemic. And I was just like, you know, why? But I would, 1 year is much like the next when you've been doing it this long, you know, I'm just like, what's the worst that can happen? I'll get more rejections. So
more wallpaper.
I just kept going. And then I found a home for it in the midst of all that, which is kind of crazy when you think about it, but that's just how it worked out.
No, that's amazing. Were you drawn to small presses for a reason, or was it very much like this other thing isn't quite going the way I wanted to. Let me explore this other option that maybe I haven't looked at yet.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy. I had an agent, a wonderful agent, and she retired. So there was a previous novel that's still not published, but she was trying to help me get it published. She was so great. And then she retired, and my heart was broken, and I had to start all over again.
Oh.
And I wrote Herrick's End, and I had a great workshop group, and they helped me polish it, and I knew it was in good shape. And then the pandemic hit. And so I thought, well, I was going to query, I'll just keep going. So I just did the usual querying. And while I was querying agents, you do so much Googling and searching and things like that. And I just came across small presses that don't require an agent. So I took my same letter that I was sending to agents and I sent it to the small presses, while I was at it, and added it into my little spreadsheet and didn't really think much of it. And then one day I got a call. Or an email, I guess it was. Hey, we really like this letter. Can you send some sample chapters? I said, oh, sure. Like I say, I've done this 1,000 times. Sure, send some chapters, forgot all about it. Can you send the whole thing? And I said, sure. Sent the whole thing. This was Tiny Fox Press. They specialize in sci-fi and fantasy. And they were hoping at this time, unbeknownst to me, to really focus in on YA. That was They really wanted to move in that direction. So I think my story landed on their desks at just the right time when they were looking for exactly that sort of thing. And that tells you how this industry works. It's so much of it is out of your control. They passed it around to the editors in the office and they reached out to me. And they said, okay, we have one question. We really want to focus on series. So is this the beginning of a series? Trilogy. And I said, sure it is. Yep.
Absolutely meant that the whole time.
Absolutely. So, right after that, I happened to be part of the Writer's Digest conference. And I did a pitch contest where you pitch your idea to agents, your novel idea, basically. And I was chatting with an agent. And I said, the weird thing is I actually have an offer right now from a publisher. Would you be interested in being my agent to help me negotiate that offer? And she said, sure. So that's how I found my agent like a week later.
Oh,
Um,
nice. I love that
so
you
it
bring
was
that
just
up.
kind of crazy. Would I have gotten that agent if I didn't already have a deal in hand? I don't know, but that's just how it happened. So
Yeah, I love that you
very
bring that up
strange.
because I've had the same experience where so I've gotten a couple interests like, hey, send us your chapters, but I'm, this industry moves pretty glacially, so I'm still waiting to hear back. But I found the same thing of if I go back to other people and say, hey, I have this person is now interested. Would you be interested because they are interested? That can really drive, somebody to look at your work.
It's so true. And that's true when you're what's called on sub as well. So if your agent submits your story to publishers, that's called being on sub, on submission. As soon as one is interested, oh boy, do the others perk up all of a sudden. It's really interesting.
Right. It's almost the kind of goes back to high school where nobody wants it until one person wants it. Now everybody wants it because they all want to be on the thing, but they don't want to take the risk of being the one on the thing.
I heard from a guy the other day who he worked at an ice cream stand, and the boss, the owner, used to tell them, work really slowly until we build up a line out front. And then work quickly because I
Yep.
want a line out front because that's what makes people stop. They all think, oh, that must be something good. There's a line. Same thing everywhere, I guess.
Totally, especially when you're selling a product that is essentially meant to be reacted to emotionally and based upon it's an art, right? I mean, a book at the end of the day is a piece of art. And so, how do you objectively tell somebody it's good that somebody else wants it? That's the only way.
Yeah, exactly. It's very strange. Why do we do this
Yeah.
to ourselves? I don't know,
Glutton for punishment.
exactly.
So once you got in at Tiny Fox Press, right, and they're looking at this novel, what did that editorial process look like for you? Was it several rounds of edits? Was it with one editor? What did that look like?
I will say they are fantastic. I mean, there are obviously pros and cons to every type of publishing, big publisher, small publisher, but what I get at Tiny Fox, I do not hear my friends getting at the big houses. I get so much direct attention because they have so few authors and they're so small. They really pay attention. If I send an email, they get back to me in 5 minutes. Like, it's crazy. It's just really wonderful. And they're great editors. They have a lot of interns that come and go as well. So you do get a lot of new, in this case, young perspective, which is really helpful for my books. So you get a lot of eyes on it. You get a lot of great feedback and opinions. And I would say it's usually at least 2 rounds, sometimes 3, but it's never crazy, crazy stuff. Like, it's never something that I get the edits and I'm like, oh my God, they want me to rewrite this whole book, or they want me to redo this whole section. It's never anything like that. It's, can you expand on blah, blah, blah? Or this part got, you know, it started to get a little bit heart tugging, but we want it really heart tugging. So can you like add a little bit there? Which I find really helpful, because as a former journalist, I'm very used to just the facts, just the facts. You know, that was drilled into me as a journalist. So I tend to write too short. I know most writers tend to write too long and have to be edited down, but I tend to write too quickly. And I gloss over things too quickly. So they're there to kind of rein me in and say, no, let's expand on that. Let's sit in that moment for a little bit longer. And that's usually what I really need to hear, because I'm never quite sure where to do that. So they've been wonderful at helping me get there.
Yeah, it's almost like a boutique experience, because you're working so closely with your editors, and you know that these editors don't have 17 more manuscripts that they have to get through and a boss that's yelling at them to get it done in a certain amount of time. They really care about the product.
Yeah, and at the big publishers, there's a whole thing called the acquisitions team, which is basically the marketing folks. And they, I believe, they really make the decision in the end of which books to take on. They're like, yeah, we think this book will sell, or it won't. So that's kind of how decisions get made at the very large publishers, because they're, you know, obviously considering the bottom line, which a small publisher is as well. But for the smaller publishers, I feel like it's a more personal thing. Like, this is my business. Like, what kind of stories do I want to tell through my business? My name is attached to this. So I just want the quality to be high, and I want to tell the kind of stories I want to tell. And at Tiny Fox, I feel like it's very quirky, fun, irreverent, sci-fi, and fantasy. That's just what they like. So they do that. And the bottom line almost seems like a secondary concern, which is kind of fun for a writer, because you know they're really in it for the love of it. Now, are you going to get rich with the small publisher? Probably not. Never say never, I guess. But, you know, for a writer who is just sort of in it for the love of writing, it's a great place to be.
Yeah, I love that. Give me just a second. My dog is scratching at the door. I'll be right back. So back to, let me reform my train of thought. So this boutique experience that you have at these small publishers, do you feel like your book is getting maybe even more attention than it would in other publishing senses?
It does at the publishing house with my own editors and the interns and everything. Out in the world, it's a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I do find that most bookstores won't carry the book, because the publisher is so small. It's a complicated thing that has to do with the discount. So when a bookstore sells a book, they buy it at a discount, obviously, and then they resell it for their price, and whatever is in between is their profit. And with the giant publishing houses, they can offer very deep discounts because they are so giant, but the smaller publishers usually can't. So, the big bookstores, the Barnes and Nobles, and even your local bookstore down the street usually won't carry my books unless I ask special, or someone asks special, or I'm doing an event there, or, you know, some particular reason. So that is, you know, definitely a challenge, because as a writer, the ultimate dream, of course, is to walk into your local bookstore and see it there on the shelf. But I will say, you can get it online. You can get it anywhere if you really want to. So it's not like it's impossible to get. It's just, you have to request it in a lot of cases.
Right.
And I do have just this week, I got a bit of exciting news that there's going to be an audio version of book one, Herrick's End. They're just starting to make it right now. They hired a narrator and they got the sound studio and all that stuff. So
Congratulations.
thank
Oh, now
you.
I'm excited for you.
It's like a dream come true because I listen to most books audio. That's how I do most of my reading while I'm walking the dog or doing my errands or whatever. So I've always, the fact that someone could download my book and listen to it on their dog walk is just thrilling to
Absolutely. Well, and that's where I was going to go next is to say that I am definitely a brick and mortar person. I want to walk into a bookstore and see my book there. Of course, like you said, every author's dream. But
Yeah.
there is a dual reality, which is that that is not how most books are sold nowadays. And that's honestly not how most books get into people's hands. And
Right.
so a lot of books are sold either through BookTok or just online in general. Goodreads is a major driver of book sales. And so it's definitely different than I would say even 10 years ago, where you really had to be in a bookstore to be sold.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily true anymore.
That is true. And the other interesting, I don't know if it's a dilemma or just an interesting thing, is this concept of an indie author. Now, if you're online at all, if you're on social media at all in the book world, you always hear that term indie author. And sometimes people will kind of lump me into that group, but that term, I never quite know what it means. Sometimes people say it to mean a self-published author, and sometimes it means published through an independent, aka small publisher. So small publishers are sometimes called indie publishers or independent publishers, meaning they're not part of the big five conglomerate.
That's how I've always understood it. And granted, everybody's experience is different when it comes to the internet. But yeah, I've always
Right.
thought
So,
indie
like, the
author.
terminology is confusing, and I don't mind being lumped in any which way category. I don't care. Just go check out my book. But it's just there's so much confusion about these things that we can't even seem to get the terminology right. So it's
And,
interesting.
yeah, well, and the terminology is evolving too, because it used to be, especially I would say more than 5 years ago, self-published was like a pariah in the industry. If you were a self-published author, that's where your career went to die. And that
Yeah.
is definitely not true anymore. I can think of three or four authors off the top of my head who were self-published first. It went big, and now they have major publishing contracts.
Nice. And I even know of some that didn't go traditional and they still do well. They still make a living
Yeah, so I
selling
think it
lots of
definitely comes
books.
down to, yeah, it comes down to what is right for your vision of your book and your work and kind of the relationship that you're willing to have with this very large business side of an artistic industry.
Yeah, and it is tough because so much of it is out of your hands and out of your control. You know, you always hear, "Oh, just write the best book you can, and everything else is out of your control." It's like, yeah, but in what other career is that true? Like,
Right.
you wouldn't go to work as a dentist or whatever and let other people control where you work, how much money you make, you know, how people are going to hear about your services or whatever it might be. It's such a strange industry in that the writer of the book has almost no control over how that book is perceived. And in most cases that I know of, the author barely has any comment on their own covers.
And yet it's their name on the cover, so they're the one that bears the brunt of any kind of
Right.
backlash of their book.
That's another place I've been really lucky with Tiny Fox. They were just basically like, "What kind of cover are you looking for? What are you thinking of?" And then they would talk to the guy and he would do a bunch of samples and they'd say, "Which one do you like best?" And I'd be like, "Oh, that one's great." And they're like, "Great, we'll use that one." Whereas my friends at the big houses sometimes just get an email, "Here's your cover." By the way, here's your cover. And they're like, "Wait, what? I don't like that cover." And they're like, "Well, sorry, it's done. That's your cover." So literally everyone judges a book by a cover, as we all know. So that's a hard one to swallow, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Well, and one thing that I've heard from, again, a lot of the people that I know that get these really traditional, really kind of narrow publishing contracts is, very often they don't have control over what the edits are. So there's no pushback. Like there's a little bit, but there's if one of the editors comes back and says, "Hey, we don't like this character and this is how we want it to be changed." And that's obviously an egregious example. But it's like you do it or you lose the contract. And I feel like that's not necessarily true at these smaller presses where it's much more of a give and take, much more of a,
Yes.
hey, let's talk about why, and then maybe we can come to a compromise.
Definitely. They usually say something to me like, oh, we'd really like it to be more like blah, blah, but if you feel strongly, we'll leave it. Like that's generally how, but I usually take their advice because they know what they're talking about. So if blah, blah is the answer, then let's do blah, blah. And it always turns out better for it, which I find is true of most feedback.
Absolutely.
You never like to hear it at first, but then you're like, oh, yeah, maybe they're right.
Yeah, I have a rule. I never respond to feedback emails within 24 hours because my first initial like reaction is always, you don't know what you're talking about. And that's usually not the case. Usually after I sit with it and I think about it, I go, oh no, that makes a lot of sense. I totally see why they wanted to do that.
Oh, that's a great idea. I'm gonna steal that idea.
Go for it. Okay. So once, right, we go through the editorial process and how long from accepted manuscript to copies in hand for you?
Well, probably good 9 months.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. You said from what? From accepted?
Yeah, accepted manuscript. You got the email. We'd love to, we'd love to start the process on this manuscript. We want to acquire it to then all through the editing process and then copies in hand published.
Well, mine was a little different because they wanted one a year for 3 years. So I knew from day one, I was going to have to get a move on. So I had to write a book a year for 3 years. The first one was already done, luckily, but I'd say from the first one, it was probably at least 9 months to a year before that first one came out. And that included the edits, but it was already in good shape. Like I say, I had a lot of workshop with this manuscript. I had a lot of feedback already. So it had been finessed many times already by the time they saw it. So there was just some pretty light edits at that point. And then I was really just frantically getting to work on book two. So
right.
Book one came out in May, and then the following year, book two came out in March. So less than a year, actually. And then this year, book three was coming out next week, April. So it's pretty evenly spaced by 1 year, but that's unusual. I think most people have 2 or 3 years between books.
I was going to say that's a really good turnaround for this industry, but it also helps to get a known 3-book, 3-year contract.
Yeah, they just like, with the series, they know people are eager to read the next one. And in fact, what I've been told is that most people won't even start reading a series until all of them are out because they like to just binge. They like to go straight through. So
I
I'm
know.
hoping that's true and maybe we'll get some nice sales now that the third one's out and things will pick up. That would be great. But
Yeah,
we'll
it's like
see.
Netflix ruined us. We all now, I can't even watch
Exactly.
TV shows. If it comes out once a week, I'm like, no, come back to me in a year. I'll watch the whole thing in 6 hours. Okay, so once you have those copies in hand, what kind of marketing now exists both on your end and on the publisher's end? What does that relationship look like for you personally?
Well, this is the downside of the small publisher. There really isn't a marketing budget per se, and the writer is really responsible for most of it, I would say, or at least that's been my experience. I knew that going in though, so I wasn't disappointed or upset. And from what I've heard of friends that are published at the Big Five, it's pretty much the same. That if you're not one of the either a debut or, one of the really big names, they don't really invest that much money on what's called mid-list writers, which is kind of everybody in between those two groups. So, there's social media, there's Amazon ads, there's things that you can do within reason. The other thing I try to do is I send out those boxes to like social media book influencer type people who will post about it and talk about it. But I don't really have a budget for it either, frankly. So between
Right.
me and the publisher, neither of us have much of a marketing budget.
No,
So
that makes sense.
yeah, I'm just left to sort of hope that word of mouth will take off. But
Well, and
either
hopefully
way.
spaces like these help too. Like you said, social media is a big tool, but it very much to me seems like it there's small bursts of virality and everything else just gets lost in the sea.
And Twitter, I had a great following on Twitter. I was very active on there, and then when it became X, I just said, I can't do this anymore.
As
So
did most people, I think.
I just left. And so now I'm, my even my social media reach shrunk down quite a bit. And but at the end of the day, I'm happy with the work. I'm thrilled with the publisher, and working with them has been a great experience. And what more can you ask, really? I really can't complain. If I stay, if 100 people read this book that's coming out next week, okay, I hope they enjoy it. That's
Right, exactly. No,
kind of all you can hope.
I think that's an excellent mindset to have about it. And I want to circle back to something that you said, because I really think people need to understand this, is that it's the same at the Big Five, unless you are one of their like star authors and you either have 7 books under your belt and they know that this is going to sell well, or you've been chosen as one of the lucky debuts. And I have a lot of friends who are not in the publishing industry ask me, they'll read a book and they'll say, how did this one become so big? And the answer, quite frankly, is that it was decided before the book ever hit shelves. It was decided this one is big.
This one is going to get the marketing dollars and the attention and the article in the Wall Street Journal and whatever it happens to be. And even then, you can't guarantee people are going to go buy the book.
Right.
So,
Right.
I've had friends who were lucky enough to get all that and still didn't get the sales that the publisher had hoped for. So you don't know what mood people are going to be in when your book comes out, frankly. What kind
Right.
of book they'll be wanting to read.
It's very much dependent upon kind of where the world is at the time that it comes out, because it takes so long for a book to come out. You can't predict what's going to happen by the time that book is finished. And I compare this a lot to, I don't know if you play video games at all, but there's a game called Animal Crossing. Okay. So you're familiar with Animal Crossing New Horizons on the Switch?
I play PS5, so I haven't done Animal Crossing, but
Okay. The only thing about Animal Crossing is that Nintendo, nobody thought this game was going to be big at all. It was like a mid-tier game. It was, they knew it was going to do well, but it came out, I think, 3 weeks into the pandemic closures, and everybody was scared, everybody was stressed, and they just wanted to feel safe and cozy. And so that became one of the biggest games of 2020, and no one could have predicted that.
Definitely. You just can't control that sort of thing. And cozy is what you want. Cozy is what you're going to find. You're not going to look for a murder mystery or something.
Exactly. And I feel like, publishing is the same, where sometimes the world is in upheaval and everybody gravitates to safe, cozy, either cookbooks or cute fantasy. Legends and Lattes was big during the pandemic, and now that we're kind of on the other side and things are a bit up in the air, I think people are gravitating more towards like gritty, dark fantasy.
That's definitely true on TV, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's hard to find anything funny on TV anymore. It's really a challenge.
Oh my goodness, I know, I miss Modern Family and just the cute, feel good. I'm gonna watch this for 30 minutes and kind of forget about things a little bit.
We used to like try to watch something like that right before bed. So you go to bed on a just a nice, happy note, and now you're like going to bed after watching people being ravaged by a serial killer.
You're
So.
right.
It's like, oh, great. Good, happy
It's
dreams.
so true. So now that you are a little ways into this publishing process, right? You're on your third book of a trilogy. What do you wish that you knew then that you know now?
I will say I sort of killed myself when that first one came out. I'm like, I'm gonna make everyone on planet Earth aware of this book if it kills me. So I spent a lot of just my personal money. I spent almost all my time. I was either writing book two or I was promoting book one. And I overdid it. I definitely overdid it, and it didn't, what's that? ROI, return on investment. I did not get my ROI. So I'm trying to now just take it easy. The last book coming out next week, I'm going to do a few events in person and online. I've sent out the book boxes. I've done what I can do. I'll do a few Amazon ads if I can afford it. And that's it. I'm not going to kill myself anymore because the ROI just doesn't work out to my benefit. So I'm just going to try to enjoy it rather than run myself ragged trying to control the world, which you just can't do.
Right. Well, and I think that's a great point about what is it that you're looking for out of the release of this book, right? Is it, you know, the fame and the glory? And my guess is that no, it's actually just that people read it and find some enjoyment in the words that you've created.
Right. Yeah. That's like the ultimate goal. And, you know, the people I really admire in life, strangely, are not writers. They're like doctors, scientists, nurses, teachers, EMTs, like just the people doing the real hard boots on the ground. You know, I come from a very blue collar background. And, you know, I feel like if someone had that kind of day, saving lives in an emergency room or something, if I can give them some entertainment, some relaxation, some like heartwarming, fun adventure stuff, that's good for me. Like that's all I really want to accomplish. So I try to just keep my books. Obviously there's conflict, there's tension because that's part of creating a plot. But in the end, I just want it to be like an enjoyable, happy, adventurous kind of experience. So if I can give that to just even a handful of people, I'll be happy at the end of the day.
I love that. And this is an attitude that I'm really only seeing from indie publishers right now. And it might change in the traditional publishers soon. But it seems like what's big right now, what people are pushing, is this kind of everything's awful, gritty. There's a romantic-y something in there somewhere, but like the awful characters doing awful things.
Right.
And I kind of miss this, hey, maybe we just read to have fun and maybe we just have a good lighthearted story that doesn't have to be too complicated and just takes us away for a little bit.
And the other thing, I'm not into romance myself, romance books or plots. I mean, my book has some in there. There's a love interest, but and I just don't see enough books where that's the case. So I really wanted to kind of do that as well. I'm not against romance. I'm in a 25-year marriage. You know, I love romance, but I like adventure stories more than that. And in particular, the new stuff I'm working on is more a female character who has an adventure, who solves a mystery, who solves a problem, and it has nothing to do with a love interest or getting a guy or any of that. So I do feel strongly about that as well. And I wish there was more of that, or more female characters just doing stuff for themselves, by themselves, without it being about a love interest. So that's
yeah,
the hill
no,
I'm gonna die on, apparently.
I know, I totally agree with that. And I do enjoy romance in my novels or what I read and what I write, but definitely as like a C plot, maybe a B plot. Like something else should be going on and there should be something else that is at stake rather than just will they, won't they?
Right. And don't get me wrong, I do read rom-coms. I enjoy that kind of stuff. I have nothing against it. I've even read romance books. I think every type of book is useful for a writer. You can learn something from every type of plot and every type of book. But just for me, you have to spend a year or 2 years with this story. It's just not enough to keep me interested at the keyboard every day. Like there has to be something a little more fantasy-like or magic or otherworldly, I guess, is sort of
Well,
more
yeah.
what draws my interest.
That goes into genre too, because, you know, if I read a romance book, that's fine. I like a romance book. I know what I'm getting into. But when I open a fantasy novel and it's basically a romance with some kind of thrown in fantasy element, I feel kind of lied to. Like I have, you know, I picked up a fantasy book for a reason because there are things that exist in the fantasy genre that I want to happen. And it doesn't have to be a J.R.R. Tolkien, you know, we're going on an epic quest for 3 years. But something should happen. There should be something more at stake. And I feel like, especially lately, perhaps that is not necessarily the case.
Well, now they have the newish romanticy, they're calling it, but which I like because I like truth in advertising. Like you say, I want to know what I'm getting. You know, if that's what I want, great. If that's not what I want, then don't call it something else, you know.
Yeah, I think, especially as things move more digital and more audiobooks, there should be like tags. You know how you can sort by tags, like on a fan fiction website or something? And so you can just say, hey, I want it to have adventure and romance and this, and you can just sort by tags that way.
Oh, that'd be great. There must be somewhere you can do that.
Right? That way you know what you're getting.
Goodreads? Does Goodreads do that? I'm not sure.
Maybe, but I've been lied
There's
to
a
by
new one,
Goodreads so many
actually. Have
times.
you heard of Shepherd?
No, I haven't.
Shepherd, a guy, I forget his name, he started it as a competition for Goodreads because he didn't like the nastiness that happens on Goodreads. So he started Shepherd, and I really like it. And they let writers make top five lists. So I get to make a top five list. The one I picked was the top five books where truth is stranger than fiction. So they were all like
Ooh.
nonfiction. And then obviously they put your book at the bottom. So, and then if you choose a book on there, I think you get similar books like listed under it. Kind of in a way Amazon does, I guess, but it's more just for book people. So yeah, that's looking really interesting. And I feel like he sends out newsletters, and I feel like he mentioned something about what you just said about tags, or they're trying to develop a way to make it much more specific. Like you can find very specifically what you're looking for.
Yeah, and I feel like this goes back to the author publisher relationship where whenever an author describes their book, I feel they do it really well. They know what genre they're publishing in, they know what the tropes are, they know how to describe their book. Whenever I see books grouped in like bookstores, and maybe it's the bookstore, maybe it's not the publisher, or sold without the author's input, a lot of times it's in the wrong place.
A friend of mine just told me he saw his book. Someone pointed out, oh, here are some five great new children's books. And his book is not a children's book. But what's he gonna say? You know? Not much
Right.
you can say at that point, but yeah, sometimes you just have to go with the flow.
Absolutely. Well, I think that is all my questions for now. So that went pretty fast. Thank you so much
Oh
for
my
being here.
goodness, it did.
Anything that you'd like to add before we get to the plugs of maybe anybody who is interested in getting their foot in the door in this industry, any advice you would have for them?
Go to conferences if you can. I know that's really hard for a lot of people in a lot of places. But if you live near any accessible type of conference, I highly recommend it because that's where you'll meet in person people who love what you love, who do what you do. It's been really invaluable for me. I happen to live in the Boston area, which I'm very lucky. There's a lot of that sort of thing here. But I know they're all over, and I have done virtual conferences, places, other parts of the country. And feedback. If you can get into any type of critique group, workshop group, oh my gosh, it changed my life. It changed my writing life and my personal life because they're such fabulous people. And just like learning how to take feedback that's given in a generous, warm spirit is invaluable.
Well, thank you so much. So that has been T.M. Blanchett, a reminder that her final installment of the Neith trilogy, Herrick's Key, is out on April 23rd. I will plug it on my Instagram as well as in the description of this episode. Yeah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.